No, you really can't. Not unless it's happened to you. But when it does, all you want is revenge. You want to take the hurt you're feeling, this acid hole in your belly, and hurl it at the person responsible. You don't just want to make them suffer. You want them to die, too. You want to take from them what they took from you.
Spitzer sat back looking uncomfortable, but curious.
Is that how you felt then? Of course it's how I felt,
said Real quietly.
But unlike most people in that situation, I could do something about it. I took the pain and hurled it right back where it belonged. And two people died. Two members of this agency, in fact. That's right. So you played the roles of judge, jury, and executioner. Judge, jury, and executioner,
repeated Real, her eyes hooded again as she stared over at the woman.
But I've been playing the executioner role for years. You people here have been handling the judge and jury part. You decide who dies, and you tell me, and then I do it. Sort of like playing God, isn't it? Who lives, who doesn't?
Before Spitzer could say anything, Real added,
Do you want to know how that makes me feel? You shrink types always like to know that, right? How we feel about every little thing?
Spitzer slowly nodded.
I would like to know. It makes me feel great. The agency does the heavy lifting. They decide who bites the bullet. I just carry out the order. What could be better? So how did it make you feel to play all three roles?
The smile that had emerged on Real's face slowly disappeared. She covered her eyes with her hands for a moment.
I didn't care for it as much. So not a role you can see yourself playing in the future?
Asked Spitzer. Real glanced up.
Why don't we cut the bullshit and just face reality, shall we? It's not a role. This is not play acting. The guy on the floor with a bullet in his head doesn't get back up when the curtain drops. My bullet, my kill, he stays quite dead. I take it you don't enjoy killing. I enjoy a job well done, but it's not like I'm a serial killer. They love it. They're obsessed with the opportunity for domination of another human being. The rituals, the details, the hunt, the strike. I'm not obsessed with any of it. It's my job. It's what I do as a profession. For me, it's a means to an end. I build a wall around it, do it, and then move on. I don't care who the target is. I only care that it's the target. It's not a human to me. It is a mission. That's all. I don't read any more into it than that. If I did, I couldn't do it.
A minute of silence passed, punctuated only by Real's accelerated breathing. Finally, Spitzer said,
You were recruited into the agency at a young age, with no college behind you. That is highly unusual. So they tell me, but I guess you don't need a degree to pull a trigger. Why did you choose to do so? You were a very young woman, barely at the age of majority. You could have done many other things in your life. Well, I didn't see many other options, actually. That is hard to believe,
countered Spitzer.
Well, you didn't have to believe it, did you? It was my choice.
Real said harshly. Spitzer closed her notebook and capped her pen. Real noted this.
I don't think our hour is up. I think that's enough for today, Agent Real.
Real rose.
I think it's enough for the rest of my life.
She slammed the door on her way out. Chapter 13. The place had several different names. Buck Chang, Puck Chang, Puk Chang. It was officially known as Kwan Li So No. 18. That meant penal labor colony in Korean. It was a concentration camp. It was a gulag. It actually was hell. Near the Taedong River in North Korea's Pyongdang, Namdo province. The oldest of North Korean labor camps, Bukchang had been hosting dissidents and alleged enemies of the state since the 50s. Unlike the other labor camps, all of which were run by the Boibu, also known as the State Security Department or the Secret Police, Bukchang was operated by the Inman Pohansong, the Interior Ministry. There were two parts to the camp. One zone was for re-education. Inmates here would learn the teachings of the country's two great dead leaders, and might be released, though they would be monitored for the rest of their lives. The other zone was for lifers, who would never see outside the camp. The majority here were lifers. Nearly the physical size of Los Angeles, Buck Chang housed 50,000 prisoners who were kept in by, among many other things, a 4-meter-high fence. If you were sent here, so was your entire family. The classic definition of guilt by association, which extended to infants, toddlers, teenagers, siblings, spouses, and grandparents. Babies born here shared the same guilt as their families. Unauthorized babies born here, because intercourse and pregnancy were strictly regulated, were killed. Age and personal culpability meant nothing, and a toddler or an ancient grandmother were treated the same. Brutally. At Buk Chang, everyone worked nearly all the time in the coal mines, cement factories, and at other vocations. All the work was dangerous. All of the workers were left totally unprotected. Many died from work accidents. Black lung disease alone had felled legions of forced coal miners. Food was largely unavailable. You were expected to scavenge for yourself, and families feasted on garbage, insects, weeds, and sometimes each other. Water came from the rain or the ground. It was dirty, and dysentery, among many other diseases, was rampant. These living conditions were used at Buk Chang as highly effective population control. It was not known precisely how many labor camps there were in North Korea, though the international consensus was 6. The fact that they were numbered, and those numbers reached at least as high as 22, was an indicator of their pervasiveness. At least 200,000 North Koreans, or nearly 1% of the entire population, call these labor camps home. There were allegations of corruption inside Buk Chang. Things were not going smoothly. For one, there had been 10 escapes in less than 2 months. That by itself was inexcusable. 2 armed battalions guarded the camp. The 4-meter-high fence was electrified with booby traps everywhere. 5-meter-high guard towers ringed the fence, and guards on the ground remained both overt and hidden, looking for any signs of problems. Thus escape should have been impossible. But since it had happened, there had to be an explanation. There were rumors that the escapees had benefited from inside help. That was not only inexcusable, it was also treasonous. The female prisoner was huddled in a corner of the stone room. She was a recent arrival here after being caught in China and repatriated. She was barely 25, but looked older. Her body was small, scarred, but also hardened and sinewy. There was strength in the small footprint. The money that she had hidden inside an orifice had been discovered. The guards had pocketed it before beating her. She now sat shivering with fear in the corner. Her clothes were rags, filthy from the trip out and now the forced journey back. She was bleeding, her hair matted and dirty. She was breathing heavily, her small chest pushing out and pulling in with each frantic breath. The heavy door opened and 4 men came in, 3 guards in uniform and the administrator of Buk Chang, who wore a gray tunic and pressed slacks. He was well-fed, his hair neatly combed into a precise side part. His shoes shined, his skin smooth and healthy. He looked down at the mess of a human in front of him. She was like an animal found by the side of the road. He would treat her as such, which was how all prisoners here were treated. Any guard showing pity or kindness would in turn become a prisoner himself. Thus no guard ever showed compassion. From a totalitarian mindset, it was a perfect arrangement. He gave orders to his men, who finished stripping her down. The administrator stepped forward and nudged her exposed buttock with his glossy wingtip. She bunched tighter, seemingly trying to melt into the wall. He smiled at this, and then drew nearer still. He squatted down. In Korean, he said, "You have money, it seems." She turned her face to his, her limbs trembling. She managed to nod. "You have earned this while away?" She nodded again. "By taking Chinese filth into your bed?"
"Yes."
"You have more money?" She started to shake her head, but then stopped. She said,
"I can get more."
The man nodded in satisfaction and looked up at the guards. "How much more?" he asked.
"More,"
she said.
"Much more."
"I want more. Much more," he answered. "When?"
"I will need to get a message out."
"How much more can you get?"
10,000 wands.
He smiled and shook his head. "Not enough. And I don't want wands."
"Renminbis, then?"
"Do I look like I want Chinese toilet paper?"
"What then?"
she said fearfully. "Euros. I want euros."
"Euros,"
she said, shivering once more since it was freezing in here and she was naked.
"What good are euros here?"
"I want euros, bitch," said the warden. "It is no concern of yours why."
"How much euros?"
said the woman. 20,000, up front. She looked shocked.
20,000 euros?
"That is my price."
"But how can I trust you?"
"You can't," he said, smiling. "But what choice do you have? The coal mine awaits." He paused. "Your record says you are from Kaichon," he said. This was known as Camp 14 and located on the other side of the Taidong River, adjacent to Bukchang. He continued, "They coddle their prisoners there. Even though we have a re-education zone here and Kaichon is only for sons of bitches that are irredeemable, we do not coddle at Bukchang. You will not leave here alive. You will be caught trying to escape, and you will be tied to a pole, your mouth stuffed with rocks, and you will be shot 5 times by each guard, and every minute you are alive will feel like death." He looked at his men. "Kaichon," he said and laughed, "for shit cuddlers." They all laughed too, grinning at each other and slapping their thighs. He stood. 20,000 euros.
"When?"
5 days.
"But that is impossible."
"Then I am sorry." He motioned to his guards, who moved forward.
"Wait, wait!"
she screamed. The men stopped and looked at her expectantly. She rose on quivering legs.
"I will get it. But I need to get a message out."
"Perhaps that can be arranged." He looked over her naked body. "You are not so scrawny. When you are cleaned up, you will be pretty, I think. Or at least, not so disgusting." He reached out and touched her hair. She flinched, and he slapped her so violently he drew blood. "You will never do that again," he ordered. "You will welcome my touch." She nodded and rubbed the skin where he had struck her and tasted the blood on her lips. "You will be cleaned up, and then you will be brought to me." She looked at him and knew what that meant.
"But the euros. I thought that was the payment."
"In addition to the euros, while we wait the 5 days. Or do you prefer the filthy, dangerous mines to my bed?" She shook her head and looked down, defeated.
I do not want to go to the mines."
He smiled and cupped her trembling chin, lifting her gaze to his. "You see? Not so difficult. Food, clean water, warm bed, and I will have you as often as I want." He turned to his men. "As will they. Any time we want, you understand? Anything we want, I don't care what it is. You are nothing but a dog, do you understand?" She nodded tearfully.
"I understand. But you will not hurt me. I have been hurt enough."
He slapped her again. "You make no demands, filth. You do not speak unless I ask you a question." He put his hands around her throat and slammed her against the wall. "Do you understand?" She nodded and said in a defeated voice,
"I understand."
"You will call me Siu Siong," he added, using the Korean word for master. "You will call me this even after you leave here, if you leave here. I make no promises, even if you get me the euros. You may not safely escape. It is up to me and me only. Do you understand?" She nodded.
"I understand."
He shook her violently. "Say it. Give me my proper respect."
Xiu Song,
she said in a tremulous voice. He smiled and let her go. See? That was not so bad. A moment later, he clutched at his throat where she had struck him. He staggered backward, colliding with one of his men. She moved so fast it seemed that everyone else had slowed by comparison. She catapulted across the room, slipped one guard's gun from his holster, and shot him in the face with it. Another guard came at her. She turned and kicked him so high her foot caught him in the eye. Her jagged toenails ripped his pupil, blinding him. He screamed and fell back as the third guard fired his gun. But she was no longer there. She had pushed backwards off the wall and cartwheeled over him, taking the knife off his belt holder as she sailed past, landing a foot behind him. She slashed four times so fast no eye could follow. The guard clutched at his neck where all his veins and arteries had been severed. She never stopped moving. Using his falling body as a launch pad, she leapt over him and caught the blinded guard in a leg lock around his head. She twisted her body in midair and hurled him forward where his head struck the stone with such force that his skull cracked. She picked up the pistol she had dropped, stood over each guard and fired into their heads until they were all dead. She had always loathed the camp guards. She had lived for years with them. They had left scars inside and outside of her that would never heal. She would never be a mother because of them. Because of them, she had never even contemplated being a mother, because that would mean she had come to accept herself as a human being, when she never could. Her name in the camp had been Bitch. Every woman in the camp had had that name. Bitch. Bitch. That was all she had ever heard from Light to Night for years on end. Come, bitch. Go, bitch. Die, bitch. She turned to the administrator, who lay on the floor near the door. He was not yet dead. He was still clutching his throat and gasping for air, his eyes unfocused but panicked. She had planned it this way, hitting him just hard enough to incapacitate but not kill. She knew exactly what the difference was. She knelt down next to him. He stared up with bulging eyes, his hands at his throat. She did not smile in triumph. She did not look sad. Her features were expressionless. She knelt down closer.
"Say it,"
she said in a whisper. He whimpered and clutched at his ruptured throat.
"Say it,"
she said.
"Xiu Song."
She cupped a hand under his neck and squeezed.
"Say it,"
he whimpered. She placed her bony knee against his crotch and pressed.
"Say it,"
he screamed as she jammed the knee down harder against his privates.
"Say it, Xiu Song, say it and no more pain."
She rammed her knee against him. He screamed louder.
"Say it.
S-s-s-"
"Say it. Say it all."
She ferociously ground her knee into him. He screamed as loud as his damaged windpipe would allow.
"Xiu Song."
She straightened. She did not smile in triumph. She did not look sad. She was expressionless.
"See? That was not so bad,"
she said, parroting his earlier words. As he stared helplessly up at her, she leapt into the air and came down on top of him. Her elbow slammed into the man's nose with such force that she pushed the cartilage there right into his brain, like a fired bullet. This killed him instantly, whereas his crushed windpipe would have taken more time to finish him off. She rose and looked around at the four dead men.
"Xiu Song,"
she said.
"Me, not you."
She searched the guard's pockets and found a walkie-talkie. She pulled it out, turned it to a different frequency, and said simply,
"It is done."
She dropped the walkie-talkie, stepped over the dead men, and walked out of the room, still naked, covered in the men's blood. Her name was Chung Cha, and she and her family had been labor camp prisoners many years ago at Camp 15, also known as Yodok. She had only been 1 year old when the Boibu had come for them in the night. They always came at night. Predators did not come during the light. She had survived Yodok. Her family had not. Other guards passed her in the hall and rushed onward to the room where the dead men were. They said nothing to her. They didn't look at her. When they got there, two of the guards vomited onto the stones after seeing the carnage. When Chung Cha reached the prearranged spot, two men who wore the markings of generals in the North Korean military greeted her with respect. One handed her a wet towel and soap with which to clean off. The other held fresh clothes for her. She cleaned and then dressed in front of them without a shade of embarrassment for her nudity. Both generals averted their gaze while she did so, although it did not matter to her. She had been naked and brutalized in front of many men. She had never had privacy and thus had no expectations of it. It simply meant nothing to her. Dogs did not require clothes. She glanced at them only once. To her, they did not look like soldiers. With their broad-rimmed, puffy caps, they looked more like members of a band ready to pick up musical instruments rather than weapons. They looked funny, weak, and incompetent. When she knew them to be cagey and paranoid and dangerous to everyone, including themselves. One said, "Yi Chung Cha, you are to be commended. His supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, has been informed and sends his personal thanks. You will be rewarded appropriately." She handed back the soiled towel and soap.
"How appropriately?"
The generals glanced at each other, their features showing their amazement at this comment. "The supreme leader will determine that," said the other. "And you will be grateful for whatever he decides." His companion added, "There is no greater honor than to serve one's country." She stared up at them both, her features unreadable. And she turned and walked down the corridor and made her way out of the camp. As she passed, many watched her. None attempted to make eye contact, not even the most brutal of all the guards there. Word of what she had done had already made its way through the camp. Thus none wanted to look Yi Sheng Cha in the eye, because it might be the last thing they ever saw. Her gaze never wavered. It pointed straight ahead. Outside the 4-meter fence, a truck awaited. A door opened, and she climbed in. The truck immediately drove off, heading to the south, to Pyongyang, the capital. She had an apartment there, and a car, and food, and clean water, and some wands in a local bank. That was all she needed. It was far more than she had ever had, far more than she had ever expected to have. She was grateful for this, grateful to be alive. Corruption could not be tolerated. She knew that better than most. 4 men dead today by her hand. The truck drove on. Chung Cha forgot about the corrupt administrator who had demanded euros and sex in payment to let her escape. He was not worth any more of her thoughts. She would return to her apartment, and she would await the next call. It would come soon, she thought. It always did. And she would be ready. It was the only life she had, and for that, too, she was grateful. No greater honor than to serve one's country? She formed spit in her mouth and then swallowed it. Chung Cha looked out the window, seeing nothing as they drew nearer to Pyongyang. She spoke to none of the others in the vehicle. She always kept her thoughts to herself. That was the only thing they couldn't take from her, and they had tried. They had tried mightily. They had taken everything else, but they had not taken that, and they never would. Chapter 14. Her apartment, until they took it away. It had a bedroom, a minuscule kitchen, a bathroom with a shower, and 3 small windows, about 200 square feet total. To her, it was a magnificent castle. Her car, until they took it away, it was a 2-door model made by the Sungri Motor Plant. It had 4 tires and a steering wheel and an engine and brakes that usually worked. Her possession of the vehicle made her a rare person in her country. The vast majority of her fellow citizens traveled on bicycles, took the metro or the bus, or simply walked. For longer commutes, there was rail. But it could take up to 6 hours to go barely 100 miles because the infrastructure and equipment were so poor. For the very elite, there were commercial aircraft. Like the rail service, there was only one airline, Air Koryo, and it flew mostly old, Russian-made aircraft. She did not like to ride on Russian wings. She did not like anything Russian. But Chung Cha had her own car and her own apartment. For now. That was stark proof of her worth to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. She walked into the kitchen and ran her hand over one of her most prized possessions, an electric rice cooker. This had been her reward from the Supreme Leader for her killing of the 4 men at Bukchang. That, and an iPod loaded with country and Western music. As she held the iPod, she well knew that it was a device that most of her fellow North Koreans didn't even know existed. And she had also been given 1,000 wons. That might not seem like much to some, but when you have nothing, anything seems like a fortune. There were 3 classes of people in North Korea. There was the core, made up of loyalists to the country's leadership, and for lack of a better term, purebloods. There was the wavering class, whose total loyalty to the leadership was in doubt. It was this class that represented the majority of the country, and for whom many lucrative jobs and government positions were out of reach. And lastly, there was the hostile class, made up of enemies of the leadership and their descendants. Only the most elite of the core group had a rice cooker, and the elite numbered perhaps 150,000 in a country of 23 million. There were more people in the prison camps. It was quite a feat for Chung Cha to have attained what she had, because her family was of the hostile class. Rice in one's belly was a mark of wealthy elite status. However, exclusive of the ruling Kim family, which lived like kings, with mansions and water parks and even their own train station, even the most elite of North Koreans existed at a level that would be looked upon as very near poverty in developed nations. There was no hot water, the electricity was totally unreliable, with only a few hours of it a day at best, and travel outside the country was nearly impossible. And a rice cooker and some songs was the reward given by one's enormously rich leadership for enduring torture and suffering, and killing 4 men and uncovering corruption and treason. But still for Chung Cha, it was far more than she had ever expected to have. A roof over her head, a car to drive, a rice cooker. It was like all the wealth in the world was hers. She moved to a window of her apartment and looked out. Her place overlooked the center of Pyongyang, with a nice view of the Taedong River. A city of nearly 3.5 million souls, the capital was by far the largest metropolis in the country. Hamhung, the next most populous city, had barely a fifth of Pyongyang's people. She liked to look out the window. She had spent a good part of her earlier life dearly wishing for a window that looked out onto anything. For over a decade at the labor camp, her wish had not come true. Then things had changed. Dramatically.
"And now look at me,"
she thought. She put on her coat and boots with the 4-inch heels that made her taller. She would never wear such footwear on a mission, but the women in Pyongyang were very much into their thin high heels. Even women in the military working construction and in the traffic police wore them. It was one of the few ways to feel, well, liberated, if that was even possible here. The monsoon season, running from June to August, had passed. The cold, dry winter would begin in about a month. Yet now the air was mild, the breeze invigorating, and the skies clear. These were the days on which Chung Cha liked to walk through her city. They were rare times, for her work carried her to many other parts of her country and the world. And there was never occasion for a leisurely walk during any of those times. On the left breast of her jacket rode her Kim pin. All North Koreans wore this decoration, depicting either or both Kim Il-sung and his son Kim Jong-il, both dead, but both never to be forgotten. Changsha did not want to always wear the pin, but if she did not, her arrest would be imminent. Even she was not so important to the state that she could ever forgo this sign of respect. As she walked, she took in observations she had made long ago. In many ways, the capital city was a 1,200-square-mile tribute to the ruling Kim family on the banks of the Taedong that flowed southward into Korea Bay. Pyongyang translated into flatland in Korean, and it was well-named. It was only 90 feet above sea level and stretched outward smooth as a bean-dead dock, or Korean pancake. The main boulevards were broad and largely devoid of cars. What passed by on the roads were mostly trolleys or buses. The city did not seem like it had millions of residents. While the sidewalks were fairly full with pedestrians, in her work, Changsha had visited cities of comparable size in other countries where far more people were out and about. Perhaps it was all the surveillance cameras and police watching that made the citizens want to hide from view. She walked down the steps to the metro. Pyongyang had the deepest subway system in the world, over 100 meters in the ground. It ran only on the west side of the Taedong, while all foreign residents lived on the east side. Whether this was intentional or not, she didn't know. But being North Korean, she assumed it was. Central planning combined with paranoia had been elevated to a high art here. Citizens queuing up for the next train did so in precise, straight lines. North Koreans were drilled from an early age to form pristine lines in under a minute. There were straight lines of humanity all over the capital city. It was part of the single-hearted unity for which the country was known. Changsha did not join the queue. She purposely waited apart from it until the train entered the station. She rode the train to another section of town and came back to the surface. The green spaces in Pyongyang were immense and many in number, but not as immense as the monuments. There was the Arch of Triumph, a copy of the one in Paris, but far bigger. It commemorated the Korean resistance to Japan from the 1920s to the 1940s. There was the Washington Monument look-alike Juche Tower that was 170 meters tall and stood for the Korean philosophy of self-reliance. As she passed it, Changsha nodded silently. She relied only on herself. She trusted only herself. No one here had to tell her that. She didn't need a monument shooting into the sky to make her believe that. There was also the Arch of Reunification, one of the few that featured Korean women. Dressed in traditional Korean garb, they held between them the map of a united Korea. The arch straddled the reunification highway, which went from the capital city all the way to the DMZ. Symbolism again, she knew. Changsha had two notions on reunification. First, it would never happen. And second, she didn't care if it did or not. She would not be unified with anyone, north or south. Later she passed the Mansudae Grand Monument, which was an enormous tribute to the memory of North Korea's founder, Il-sung, and also to his son, Jong-il. Changsha passed by this monolithic structure without looking at it. This was a bit dicey on her part. All North Koreans paid tribute here by standing and gazing lovingly at the statues of the two men. All brought flowers. Even foreign tourists were required to lay floral offerings here, or else be arrested and or deported. Yet Changsha walked on, almost daring a nearby policeman to stop her. There were limits to her patriotism. Towering over the entire city was the white elephant of Pyongyang, the Ryoyang Hotel. It was begun in 1987, but construction funds ran out in 1992. Although construction had restarted in 2008, no one knew if it would ever be completed or whether even one guest would sleep there. For now, it was a 330-meter-high monstrosity, with nearly 4 million square feet of space in the shape of a pyramid. Interesting central planning there, she thought. Her belly grumbling, Changsha entered a restaurant. North Koreans typically did not eat out because it was a luxury most could not afford. If a group did go out, it was usually on state business with the government footing the bill. At times like that, the workers would eat and drink prodigious amounts, going home drunk on soju or rice liquor. She had passed other restaurants offering typical Korean fare like kimchi, spicy pickled vegetables that every Korean woman knew how to make, boiled chicken, fish, and squid, as well as the luxury of white rice. She kept going past all of these and entered the Sam Tae-sung Hamburger Restaurant, which served burgers, fries, and shakes. Chung Cha had often tried to reconcile in her mind how a restaurant serving what would be recognized around the world as American food could exist here when there was not even a U.S. embassy located in Pyongyang because the two countries did not have official diplomatic relations. An American citizen in trouble here had to go crawling to the Swedish embassy, and even then, only for medical emergencies. She was one of the few patrons here, and all the others were Westerners. She ordered a hamburger rare, fries, and a vanilla milkshake. The waiter looked at her severely as though silently admonishing her for eating this Western garbage. When she showed him her government ID, he bowed perfunctorily and hurried away to fill her order. She had chosen a seat with her back against the wall. She knew where the entrances and exits were. She noted anyone moving in the space, whether it was toward or away from her. She didn't expect trouble, but she also anticipated that anything could happen at any time. She ate her meal slowly, chewing her food thoroughly before swallowing. She had endured starvation for well over a decade. That hollow feeling in your belly never left you, even if you had ample food the rest of your life. Her diet at Yodak had consisted of whatever she could find to eat, but mostly corn, cabbage, salt, and rats. At least the rats had given her protein and helped to stave off diseases that had killed many other prisoners. She had become quite adept at catching the rodents, but she liked the taste of the burger better. Chung Cha was not fat, and never would be. Not so long as she was working. Maybe as an aged woman living somewhere else, she would allow herself to grow obese, but she did not dwell on this prospect for long. She doubted she would live long enough to grow old. She finished her meal and paid her bill and left. She had one place she wanted to go, something she wanted to see, although she had already seen it before. Everyone in North Korea probably had. It had been recently moored on the Botong River in Pyongyang to become part of the Fatherland Liberation War Museum. This was so because it was a ship, a truly unique ship. It was the second oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy after the USS Constitution, and it was the only U.S. naval vessel currently held by a foreign power. The USS Pueblo had been in North Korean hands since 1968. Pyongyang said it had strayed into North Korean waters. The United States said it had not. The rest of the world used 12 nautical miles out to sea as the demarcation for international waters. However, Pyongyang did not follow what other countries did and claimed a 50 nautical mile boundary. The Pueblo was now a museum, a testament to the might and bravery of the homeland and a chilling reminder of the imperialist intentions of the evil America. Chung Cha had taken the guided tour, but she did so with a perspective different from other visitors. She had read an uncensored account of the sailors aboard the Pueblo. This was an unheard-of thing in her country, but Chung Cha's work often carried her out of North Korea. The sailors had been forced to say and write things that they did not believe, like admitting to spying on North Korea and denouncing their own country. But in a famous photo of some of the seamen, they surreptitiously had been giving the finger to the North Korean cameraman and symbolically to their captors, while seemingly just clasping their hands. The North Koreans did not know what a raised middle finger meant and asked the sailors about it. To a man, they said it was a Hawaiian symbol of good luck. When Time magazine had run a story exposing the truth of the gesture, The sailors were reportedly severely beaten and tortured, even more than they already had been. When they were released in December 1968, 82 of them walked single file across the Bridge of No Return in the DMZ. One sailor had not walked across. He had died in the initial attack on the ship, the only fatality of the incident. Chung Cha finished the tour and made her way back to land. She looked back at the ship. She had been told that the Americans would not decommission the ship until it was returned to them. Well, then it would never be decommissioned, she thought. North Korea had very little, and so they never gave anything back that they had taken. After the Soviets had left and North Korea had its independence, it was thought it was this little country against the world. It had no friends. No one that truly understood it, not even the Chinese, whom Chung Cha considered to be among the wiliest race on earth. Chung Cha was not a religious person. She knew no North Koreans who were. There were some Korean shamanists, others who practiced Shintoism, some Buddhists, and a relative handful of Christians. Religion was not encouraged since it could be a direct challenge to the country's leaders. Marx had had it right, she thought. Religion was the people's opium. Yet Pyongyang had once been known as the Jerusalem of the East because of the Protestant missionaries who had come in the 1800s, with the result that over 100 churches had been erected on the flat land. That was no more. It was simply not tolerated. And to her it did not matter. She did not believe in a benign higher being. She could not. She had suffered too much to think of a heavenly force in that sky that would let such evil walk the earth without lifting a hand to stop it. Self-reliance was the best policy. Then you alone were entitled to the rewards, and you alone bore responsibility for the losses. She passed an open street market and stopped, tensing for a moment. There was a foreign tourist not 5 feet from her. It was a man. He looked German, but she could not be sure. He had his camera out and was about to take a picture of the marketplace and the vendors. Chung Cha looked around for the tour guide who must accompany all foreigners. She did not see the person. The German had his camera nearly up to his eye. She shot forward and snatched it from him. He looked at her, stunned. "Give that back," he said in a language that she recognized as Dutch. She did not speak Dutch. She asked him if he spoke English. He nodded. She held up the camera.
"If you take a picture of the street market, you will be arrested and deported. You might not be deported, actually. You might just stay here, which would be worse for you."
He paled and looked around to see several Korean vendors staring at him with malice. He sputtered, "But why? It's just for my Facebook page."
"You do not need to know why. All you need to do is put your camera away and go and find your tour guide. Now, you will not receive another warning."
She handed him back the camera and he took it. "Thank you," he said breathlessly. But Chung Cha had already turned away. She did not want his thanks. Maybe she should have just let the crowd attack him. Let him be beaten, arrested, thrown in prison, and forgotten about. He was one person in a world of billions. Who would care? It was not her problem. Yet as she walked down the street, she thought of the man's question. "But why?" he had asked. The answer to that was both simple and complex. An open street market said to the world that North Korea's economy was weak, its traditional stores few in number, and thus the need for vendors in the street. That would be a slap in the face to a leadership acutely sensitive to world opinion. Conversely, an abundance of goods at a street market, if seen by the rest of the world, could result in international food aid being reduced. And since many North Koreans were barely surviving, that would not be a good thing. Pyongyang was not representative of the rest of the country, and yet even people here starved to death in their apartments. It was part of the so-called eating problem, which was very simple. There was not enough food. This was why North Koreans were shorter and lighter than their brethren to the south. Chung Cha did not know if either of these explanations was true. She only knew that these were the unofficial explanations for why the simple act of taking a picture could have such horrendous consequences. In addition to the fact that North Koreans did not like to have their picture taken by foreigners, and things could get violent, the perpetrator would be arrested. That was reason enough never to leave your tour guide's side while in North Korea.
Our ways are just different because we are the most paranoid country on the face of the earth. And perhaps we have good reason to be. Or perhaps our leaders want to keep us united against an enemy that does not exist.
She didn't know how many other North Koreans had such thoughts. She did know that the ones who had publicly expressed them had all been sent to the penal colonies. She knew this for a fact. Because her parents had been sent to Yodok for doing that very thing, she had grown up there. She had nearly died there, but she had survived, the only one of her family to do so. And her survival had come at a terrible price. She had had to kill the rest of her family to be allowed to live. Chapter 15. Roby looked at Real. Real studied the floor. It was nearly midnight, a week into their stay here. After their psychological vetting, they had undergone more physical endurance tests, each more difficult than the last. They had been given a bit of food and water and then brought back here, sweaty and tired and increasingly depressed. Over the next days, they had been worked relentlessly and had dropped exhausted into their bunks for a few hours of sleep before they were hustled from their beds and had all started up again. Tonight, they had gotten off relatively early, and so this was the first real time they had been able to speak to each other since the first day.
"How did your shrink session go?" asked Roby, finally breaking the silence in their tiny shared room.
"Great. How about you?"
she said sarcastically. "We spent a good deal of time talking about you, actually."
She looked up at him and then stared over at the nearest listening device. She glanced back at him and mouthed, "Here? Now?" He looked around the room and noted the video cameras that they both knew were embedded in the walls. He flipped up the mattress so that it leaned against his back, effectively shielding him from view. Then he motioned for her to sit on the other side of the bunk and face him. She did so, staring at him curiously. Then he began using sign language. He had been taught this, as had Real, he knew, because silent communication was often very useful in the field. He said in sign, "Marx is Evan Tucker's person, through and through. Can't believe we're intended to survive this place. Do we make a break for it?" Real thought about this and signed back. "Gives them a great excuse to kill us and no repercussions." He signed, "So we sit tight? I think we can survive this." "What's your plan?" "We recruit Marx to our side." Roby's eyes widened. "How?" "We suffer together." "You've been bitchy to her so far. How can you turn that around?"
"I was bitchy to her for the very reason that would allow me an opportunity to turn it around with credibility. If she thinks I hate her, it could work. If I started out nice, she would have been instantly suspicious."
Roby still looked dubious. Real signed, "What other option do we have?"
"None," he signed. "Except die." At that moment, the door burst open, and a half-dozen armed men came in. Roby and Real were shackled and then hustled out of the room. They were hurried down one long hall after another. They were being moved so fast, neither Real nor Roby could get a handle on which direction they were going. A door was thrown open and they were pushed inside. The door slammed shut behind them and other hands grabbed them. Real and Roby were lifted off their feet and each was placed prone on a long board. The room was dimly lighted, but they could still see each other, being only inches apart. They both knew what was coming. They were strapped to the boards, and the boards were tipped back. Their heads were submerged in a large bucket of icy water. They were held there nearly long enough to be drowned. When they were lifted free from the water, their feet were kept elevated. Next, a thin cloth was placed over their faces, and icy water poured over it.
The liquid quickly saturated the cloth and then filled their mouths and noses. The gag reflex was nearly immediate. They coughed and spit. More water was poured. They coughed and gagged. More water was poured. They both retched. The cloth was lifted, and they were allowed to snatch 3 or 4 normal breaths before the cloth went back on. The water was poured again, with the same result. The process was repeated over the next 20 minutes. Both Real and Roby had vomited what little was in their stomachs. All that was coming out now was bile. They were kept on the boards with the cloth over their faces. Neither knew when the water would start up again, which was all part of the technique. No training in the world could really insulate you from the terrors of waterboarding. They both lay there gasping, their limbs pressing against the restraints, their chests heaving. Normally, interrogation would start now. Both Roby and Real knew this, but they each wondered what sort of interrogation they would be subjected to. The lights dimmed even more, and both of them braced for what might be coming next. A voice said, "This can stop. It's up to you." It was not Amanda Marks. It was a male voice neither of them recognized.
"What's the price?"
gasped Real. "A signed confession," said the voice. "Confessing what?" said Roby, spitting retch from his mouth. "For Real, the murders of 2 CIA operatives. For you, aiding and abetting her. And also to account of treason."
"You a lawyer?"
sputtered Real. "All I need is your answer." Real's next words made the man chuckle. He said, "I'm afraid that is physically impossible for me to do to myself. But that's an answer in itself, I suppose." 20 more minutes of waterboarding occurred. When they came back up for air, the same question was posed. "This will stop," said the voice. "All you have to do is sign." "Treason carries the death penalty," gasped Roby. Then he turned to the side and threw up more bile. His brain was about to explode and his lungs felt seared. Real interjected.
"So what the hell does it matter?"
"It does matter. You'll be given lengthy prison terms, but you won't be executed. That's the deal. But you have to sign the confession. It's all prepared. You just have to sign." Neither Roby nor Real said anything. The ordeal went on for 20 more minutes. When it finished, neither of them was conscious. This was one drawback to this form of torture. The body just shut down. And there was no purpose in torturing an unconscious person. The lights came on, and the man stared down at the pair strapped to the long boards. "An hour. Impressive," he said. His name was Andrew Viola. Up until last year, he had been the chief trainer at the burner box. And before that, a legendary CIA field agent who had a hand in some of the most complex and dangerous missions of the last 25 years. He would be 50 on his next birthday. He was still fit and trim, although his hair was an iron gray and his face heavily lined, and scarred from one mission that had not gone according to plan. He looked over at Amanda Marks, who had been observing the entire process, with a look of slight revulsion. "Not for the weak of stomach or heart," he said.
"And I didn't exactly understand the purpose. Did we really expect them to sign a confession?"
"Not my call. I was told to do this, and I did it. CIA lawyers and upper management can figure out the rest."
"This was my mission to run,"
she said. "And it still is, Amanda. I'm not stepping on toes here, but I had my orders, and..." He glanced down at Roby and then Real. "Unlike some, I always follow orders."
"So what now?"
"My work here is done until I'm called up again. So I might see these two again before they leave here. If they leave here," he corrected himself.
"They both believe they were brought here to die,"
said Marks. "And you don't think that's a possibility?" asked Viola, looking mildly surprised. "Recruits do die here. It's rare, but it happens. This is not summer camp, Amanda."
"That's different. Accidents happen. And Roby and Real are not recruits. They are vets and battle-tested. But if the purpose was from the start..."
He cut her off. "Don't try to think too much about it. Just do your job. You'll be happy and so will the higher-ups.
And that doesn't bother you?
He glanced sideways at her. Maybe in the past. Maybe. But not anymore.
What changed?
We were attacked. The towers fell, the Pentagon was hit, planes crashed, Americans died. Now I try to see the world only in black and white.
The world is not black and white.
That's why I said I try to do it. He turned and left the room. Marks came forward and stared down at the two unconscious agents. She thought back to her meeting with Evan Tucker before coming here. The director had been understandably clear on the outcome he wanted. On the surface, it appeared fair and even-handed. If they passed the test they passed, they would be redeployed, simple and straightforward. But then this had come. The order for the waterboarding to be conducted by Viola. The man was excellent at his job, Marks knew. But he had, well, a ruthlessness. A moral compass that did not seem to actually encompass any morals at all. That bothered her. A signed confession admitting to murder and treason? That had to have come from Evan Tucker. No one else in the agency would have dared issue such an order. So the rules had changed. Tucker was using the burner box not only to test and break Roby and Reel. He also wanted them to admit to acts that would result in their imprisonment. He had not told her this part of the plan. He had been wise not to, because Marks would have refused. The seemingly simple thought stunned her. She had never before refused to carry out a direct order. It was just not something one did. Failing to do that had been the cause of both Roby's and Reel's current troubles. Am I becoming like them? She heard Roby and Reel moan, and then they started to come around. She turned to one of her men.
Take them back to their room. Let them sleep. I'll give directions for when their next testing will begin.
This order was carried out immediately. She watched Roby and Reel being carried back to their room. Their prison cell, more like it. Maybe their death row. Chapter 16. Roby woke first. There were no windows in the room, so he had no idea what time it was. Their watches had been taken from them on arrival. He slowly sat up and rubbed his aching head. He leaned over from the top bunk and saw Reel was sleeping in the lower berth. Roby swallowed with difficulty and cringed when he tasted the remnants of the vomit still in his mouth and throat.
Sucks, doesn't it?
He looked down again to see Reel staring up at him. Not something I'd want to go through every day. He swung his legs over the edge and dropped to the floor and sat down on her bunk. She curled up her legs to give him room.
To what purpose?
She asked.
They couldn't really believe we'd sign a confession.
Roby looked up at the listening device, but Reel shook her head.
I don't care if they hear.
She sat up and said in a loud voice,
not confessing to jack shit.
She looked back at Roby, who was smiling.
What?
She demanded. Nothing. Well, I just like your subtle style, Jessica. She started to snap something back, but then stopped and laughed. He joined in for a few seconds, and then they both grew quiet as footsteps approached. The door opened and both of them immediately drew back, ball tight, hands up, reflexes ready. Taking them again would require a fight.
However, only Evan Tucker stood there.
Roby shot Reel a glance. Her look was so ferocious that he was afraid she was about to attack the DCI. He was actually putting out his arm to forestall this when she said,
good morning, Director. Did you have a nice sleep last night? We did. Best in years.
Tucker managed a tight smile at this comment and then sat down on the chair opposite them. His suit was wrinkled, and the collar of his shirt slightly grimy, as though his journey here had not exactly been at first-class levels. I know what happened to you last night. I ordered it. Good to know, said Roby. So is that a confession? Because I thought the use of waterboarding was illegal. It is illegal for purposes of interrogation on detainees. Neither of you are detainees. and it was not done for interrogation purposes.
We were asked to sign confessions,
Real pointed out. A subterfuge only. There were no confessions for you to sign. That's not what the guy said last night. And the terms of the confession he recited were pretty specific, noted Roby. He had his script and he stuck to it. But there was no confession.
So what was the point of the thing, then?
Demanded Real. To see if you two can still cut it. The mission you're to be deployed on entails the risks of being caught. And the enemy is known to use waterboarding, among other interrogation tools, to break prisoners. It's not all about being able to shoot straight.
And so this had nothing to do with the hard-on you have for me, Director?
Said Real.
You really expect us to believe that?
I don't care what you believe or don't believe. I've made my position on you very clear. You murdered two of my people and got off scot-free. I think that stinks. I think you should be in jail, but it's not my call. I still have my job to do, and so do you. My job is to keep this country safe against outside threats. You two are tools that I have at my disposal. I will deploy you as necessary. If I think it wise to push your butts to the wall and then through it, I will do so. If you feel you can't cut it, then you can tell me right now, and we can cut out all this bullshit. He stopped talking and looked at them expectantly. And if we want out, said Roby, then that can be made to happen. But chances are very good that your partner will be prosecuted for murder, and you as an accessory.
So if we stay in and maybe get killed, either by the other side or our own people, we don't end up in court?
Said Real. Did you really expect anything more generous than that? Said Tucker skeptically. You want to begin to wipe the slate clean of what you did, then suck it up. Finish up here and successfully execute the upcoming mission. If you want to cut and run, then that's a whole other ballgame. Your choice, but make it now. I don't have time to waste. Is that why you're here? Asked Roby. To deliver the ultimatum? No. I'm here to finally lay to rest any misconception you two might have about my motives. You are not sent here to be killed. I'm far too busy to even have time to think about something like that. The fact is, in the grand scheme of things, none of us is that important. Now, we have an opportunity to do something that will make the world a far better, far safer place. I need to know that you're with me on this 1,000%, or I have no use for you at all. Again, your decision. And again, I need it now. He once more quieted and looked at them. Roby was the first to speak. I'm in. Real nodded.
Me too.
Glad to hear it. Tucker rose, opened the door, and was gone. Before Real and Roby could even say a word, they heard the sounds of someone else approaching. A few moments later, the orderly wheeled the cart in. It was loaded with breakfast foods and a carafe of coffee. Another orderly brought in two foldable chairs. They set up the table, laid out the food and coffee, and departed. Real and Roby had not moved the entire time. Finally, they looked at each other. You think there's cyanide in it? He asked.
I don't care, I'm starving.
They rose, sat down in the chairs, and attacked the food and drank down the hot coffee. They said nothing as they devoured the meal. Then they sat back, looking both satisfied and energized. Real said,
You can never overestimate the effect of a good meal on one's spirits.
Yeah, but maybe it's just that they're fattening the calf before leading it to slaughter.
So that was our last meal before execution?
Wish I could tell you one way or another, Roby replied. Before Tucker showed up, I was pretty sure we were done for. Now I'm not so sure.
Strange, he came all this way to tell us something we already knew.
You think he was sincere?